You're listening to Building Bridges, your community and labor reports, conversation with Harry Belafonte, produced at the studios of WBAI in New York City by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Only can the spirit
turn the world around. You built a lot of bridges there, a lot of bridges between the civil rights, the class movements. I'm wondering where the product that you produce, Hollywood, where that fits in. People sort of put that in a separate corner and say there's politics and there's entertainment. How do you use politics in what you do, and how does Hollywood use it? Is it just entertainment?
First of all, I must tell you that I may be rare to this thought. At least one does not hear it popularly expressed. But I don't believe there's a separation between entertaining and not entertaining when it comes to art. First of all, I think all art is political. I think all art makes a social statement. In 1935, I saw a film called Tarzan of the Apes. And that early, the magic of the screen was still a very new experience for most people. I mean, the Hollywood thing and the big screen and the stories that it told just entranced us all. Just like the internet does today for so many people who are experiencing that technology and what it accesses. It was very much the same kind of a gene that was in the society of the day in the early days of film. And film carried an enormous power to influence, because everybody looked at the screen and accepted that what they were seeing was true, accepted that what they were seeing had a lot of believability to it. And just before Tarzan of the Apes, one of the greatest instruments to define the power of the technology, and very well done from a craft point of view, was a film called Birth of a Nation, which told of the Civil War and told of Africans and our struggle in that. And we were painted as rapists and as ignorant and as violent. And I mean, it sent out a message to America and an image of who we were as a people that was so distorted that we've never retrieved ourselves even today from that one moment in our history. I mean, the film so violated sensibilities that for a long time after that film had been released, black people were being lynched just in the spirit of that film. That was the power of the media. When I saw Tarzan of the Apes, it was very entertaining. I mean, everything about it was entertaining, but it was also filled with information that Africans were dumb, that they lived in the jungle and had no control over it, they had no relationship to fellow creatures, and that if it had not been for the presence of this white Adonis, this marvelous, physical, blonde, blue-eyed guy swinging through the trees, whose only vocabulary was some kind of a guttural utterance, "Aiya," which said everything to every creature in the forest. I left that theater as a child, and I remember very clearly that I never wanted to ever have anything to do with an African. And when people tried to describe me as somehow being a descendant of all that, I rebelled. It was a shameful brand to be given. So when people tell me that art and entertainment and it's not political and whatnot, I hasten to point out that whether it's Judy Garland skipping through the streets of St. Louis singing on a trolley car, or it's Arnold Schwarzenegger doing something with the Terminator, every inch of film, every piece of art, every book that's written that has anything to do with the defining of social conduct and social interrelationships carries a message and carries something that will impact on a mind that's translated politically.
I was just thinking back. I remember when the Springboks were doing their tour here from South Africa during the era of apartheid, and people said, no, keep your hands off. This is sports. This has nothing to do with the politics of racism and racialism and apartheid. Yes, it did. And trying to convince Jimmy Cliff and Dakota Staton not to go to South Africa. But you formed a relationship for decades and decades, indeed, with Africa, with Nelson Mandela's. What is the importance, and what is your sense of the role of the Mandelas and the role of Africa and the responsibility and the role of people here to a continent that they have abused so badly?
I think any people, regardless of their station in life, but particularly people who are oppressed, are constantly in need of reaffirmation that there is a lot that they can do, that there is hope, that there is, through organization, the capacity to overthrow the mightiest of the machinery that we think is invincible. In Nelson Mandela, a man who was brutalized, and his people were brutalized by the European conquest, spent 27 and a half years of his life in a prison, in a system that seemed to have been invincible and immovable. Civil rights here in America, Dr. Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Fannie Lou Hamer, Ella Baker. These people who dared to step to the table of resistance and say nothing is so great and so inviolate that it cannot be changed if it is oppressive. And I think that people need to see when leaders emerge, especially if they're leaders who come out of their ranks, they see commonality. I often say to people, I think we should stop dreaming and wishing for another Dr. King. First of all, I believe that there may be thousands of Dr. Kings who exist. What made Dr. King unique to his time was that history coincidentally moved to a place where he coincidentally happened to be that gave him the opportunity to rise to an occasion. One does not always have the capacity to go out and create their own moment. I often say that history makes leaders far more easily than leaders make history. And Dr. King, Malcolm X, Fannie Lou Hamer, Ella Baker, Mandela, what all of these people have in common is that they came out of the community of the oppression, and they articulate for those who come from there so that the people who are from there can readily understand what must be done and are inspired by how they lead. And I have always found that the use of my platform as an artist and the fact that there is this high profile globally is best greeted and best used when it is in the service of fulfilling the mission of those prophets that I've just defined. Most recently, just a few days ago, I had dinner with Madiba, Nelson Mandela, and I still sit in his service. And we talk and exchange thoughts on a myriad of subjects that have to do with race, have to do with the world condition. The most immediate problem, and the one that we're looking at different kinds of methodology to try to fix, is the whole issue of HIV/AIDS and its impact upon the peoples of the world. The most severe experiences that exist at the moment happen to be in the continent of Africa. 27 million people are affected. In that context, 10 million children have become orphaned by their parents who have died from it, and these kids have been left to the wilds of the world. The ignorance on the subject of AIDS among the populace of the peoples of that continent is the greatest fuel to the escalation of the plague. Myths that exist in what people think and what people hear and what people are driven to believe is a very, very difficult problem to overcome. Most of the people of Africa cannot read. Most of the people of Africa cannot write. Very few of the peoples of Africa have access to television sets. Radios are a little bit more dominant. But even then, not everyone has access to the radio. And these are the peoples that are the breeding grounds for this disease to grow rapidly. When you have 10 million children who are orphaned, and no one to care for them, no one to give them guidance. More often than not, many of those kids are recruited into these child armies, and they become the participants in so much villainy on that continent with rebellions, and not that all rebellion is evil, but there's most rebellions that take place in Africa are waged around issues that have done nothing but destroy people rather than to uplift the communities. And when you look at Sierra Leone, for instance, when you look at the carnage that exists there and the violence, and you look at the young children, some who have just been born into life, who are walking around with no limbs because they've been chopped off in the aggression of war, and you look at who it was that chopped off those limbs, and it's a 12-year-old child who happens to be carrying a weapon of destruction. It's a devastating thing that's going on in Africa. And I think that the world has got to begin to pay more attention and end its indifference. Because if Africa sinks, it'll leave a hole so big, it'll suck in the rest of the world. So a lot of people have got to understand that they're inextricably bound to the destiny of that continent and the peoples. And Nelson Mandela is trying to put together, among a number of things that he's putting together, including his Peace Institute and the educational uplifting of the peoples of Africa. He's trying to put together a mechanism that will be able to reach large masses of people and to disseminate information that might stimulate their thinking and their caution about the villainy of AIDS and HIV. And one of the greatest ways in which to do that, because the continent is so culture-bound and so historically culture-interested, that it is through artists that we might be able to go into villages and to make alliances and whatnot and just go and sing and to tell stories and to put on demonstrations and displays that will capture the imagination of people and lead them to new truths. We feel somewhat energized by the possibilities of this because such a mobilization was used when we went on our immunization campaign under Jim Grant at UNICEF in the United Nations to get the children of our planet immunized for the diseases that we knew we could cure, like chickenpox and measles and stuff. And when there was a resistance to getting the immunization program as fully integrated into people's thinking as everyone thought it would be, it was artists who went out and campaigned and made people in villages understand that having your child inoculated was the good thing to do and nothing that they, and things that they should not fear. And it worked very well.
You said something that I can't help but exploit a little bit here, that you had three radios in the house, and all of them were tuned to WBAI. Those of us who are fortunate enough to relate to WBAI are very proud of it because we feel that it does have a more profound and substantive look, that the equation is not commodification, that there's a social consciousness such as you've been speaking about with us. And I was wondering about how you look at the reality of media.
How can we hold media? How can we hold the press? How can we hold journalism accountable? It is not about violating First Amendment. As a matter of fact, if you look at what media does in many instances, what it does is violate First Amendment. Those airways do not always give a well-rounded editorial, all-encompassing political point of view. The media and the airways and the press should be fully open to a debate among leaders who have issues and things to discuss. There should not even have to be a political financing reform issue. There should be no political financing. In that sense, I think that we should have a forum by which the politics of life and the social destiny issues are debated openly and freely and supported and mandated by constitution and by countries, so that we do have free, really and truly free speech and free ideas and free thoughts, so we can be stimulated in the choices that we make to better life. In fact, when you get the monopoly on the press that is had by a few industrialists and a few very powerful men, most, if not all, are white, when you get them locking into a place of self-interest so that everything is almost the same voice editorially, it becomes a great challenge on how to break that monopoly. But we must try to find solution, because in the 21st century, with the technology of internet and computers and how we can access one another, which is not without its own control too, incidentally, while we're talking about it. People somehow talk about all this stuff being free and people can have instant contact with one another, although a lot of that has a truth in it. It would make you think that somehow this mechanism of the internet and computer stands without somebody putting an on and off button. Somebody controls how all that information can flow and when to pull the plug and not to pull the plug. So I think we have to be vigilant on who controls the human family's capacity to talk to itself and who filters how and what we say. And I think that if I were to pick one single villainy, that if we could fix it, we could almost fix everything else. It would be how we disseminate information and how we access ourselves to a truly free and open press.
What do you see the role of a radio station like WBAI in that? What should we be focusing on?
I think what you do is the way it should be done. I think that what BAI does is to give me an opportunity to use such diverse information. It is so multicolors. The mosaic that BAI offers gives me a chance to hear issues and hear people speaking to issues that I don't get in the popular press and through popular media. And I think we need more BAIs, not less. I think we must tenaciously protect the one we have and what it does in its capacity to reach many minds across the length and breadth of our nation. But I do believe that we have got to become far more responsible for what it is that we're getting off the airways. And what we get off in the name of entertainment is always, in some instances, even more villainous than what we're getting from what we call breaking news and the hard edge and the cutting edge of news reporting.
You know, I should get in trouble if I don't mention it. We haven't even touched on music. Now, there's this wonderful little piece in one of your bios that talks about when you were starting out in music and you're playing at a club and there's this group of musicians who kind of get together and they're a background band. And, well, you weren't too well known at the time, but I think their names were Miles Davis, Max Roach, Charlie Parker. My goodness. We got to ask something about the music. And here I go into adulation again, playing with musicians like that. My goodness, what a wonderful thing to have as part of one's life.
I couldn't agree more to have been blessed by the generosity of those men and what they saw in me as a young aspirant. It was also part of what helped shape my own commitment to social association that reinforces and helps us one another move on to a higher level of experience. I was a student at the New School of Social Research here in New York after just coming out of the war, out of the armed forces. And I used the GI Bill of Rights, the stipend that was given for us to go further our academic in the school. My classmates were Marlon Brando, Walter Matthau, Rod Steiger, B. Arthur, just to name a few. And not too far from our school, which was on 8th Avenue, I think, and 50th Street, was the theater, because the school itself was in downtown. On 12th Street. But we had physical property on Houston Street, downtown, and on 50th Street and 8th Avenue, a place called the President Theater, small theater. The school owned it, and it was there that we did our plays. So we were almost instantly accessible to Broadway. We were in the Broadway world. And our working day in class was 14 hours, because beyond the curriculum and the academic process, you also had to have production time. So when you got through with the school part of it, and the learning part of it, and the book part of it, and the technique part of it, at night we have responsibility in the theaters to either we were acting in a play or producing the play or set designers or the lighting and all that theater is made of. At the end of our theater experience, I would go in for a 50-cent bottle of beer and admission into a place called the Royal Roost, which was on Broadway, and I think between 48th and 49th Street. And in this basement was a place called the Metropolitan Opera House. And in it was this phenomena being experimented with called modern jazz and bebop. And I would go down there and with this anonymity just go to the bar, which was the bleacher section. I didn't have enough money to go sit and pay the $2.50 minimum at the table. And nurture this bottle all night long until the hours of the morning, just listening to Lester Young, to Billie Holiday, to all the men that you just mentioned. And through the years, on a bad night, on a rainy night, and I got to know the manager of the club and whatnot, they let me sometimes go sit at a table when it was a very slow night and give me a sandwich for the cost of it instead of the price that was on the menu. And I developed this relationship. And I told them about my school, and I told them about what we were doing, and that we were just now working on Jean-Paul Sartre, because we were the first institution in America to introduce Jean-Paul Sartre and the whole issue of existentialism and whatnot in a play called The Flies. And Piscotta would come from the Max Reinhardt Theater in Germany, and who was from the world of Bertolt Brecht. And Charlie Parker and Lester Young would listen to me with absolute fascination. And you do Shakespeare, and you do this, and I'd get them to come over. I want you to come on over, I'll get you a ticket and see what we're doing and whatnot. And of course, when they saw the likes of a Walter Matthau and a Rod Steiger and a B. Arthur and a Marlon Brando, they were seeing some rather hefty artists here. We developed this kind of relationship, and I admired much of it. Now, central to the story, I ran out of money. GI Bill dried up. I was not going to be able to get work, and I didn't know where to go and what to do. In a play that we'd done, it was Steinbeck's Of Mice and Men, one of the characters in the play and the role that was written as a device for scene transitions, I played this kind of Woody Guthrie character, a minstrel walking across the plantations of America in the fields and where this play took place, and I sang a lot of Woody Guthrie songs as the transition and background sounds in the middle of these scenes. And the manager of the club, a man named Monte Kay, saw me, and he was one of the ones I was friendly with. When I sat down one night and told him about my problems, he said, "Well, look, I heard you sing in the play. You carry a decent melody. Why don't you come on and I'll make you the intermission singer in between sets and in between seating the customers. And you make, maybe $75 a week." Well, that was more money than I'd ever heard of. And I would be able to also continue my studies over at the New School. And he said, "Well, I don't have any songs except a few folk songs I sang in the play. And I have no repertoire." He says, "Well, I'll get you a piano player. And you sit down and learn a few songs and put it together. There's not much pressure." I said, "Well, I embrace you for your generosity, and I'll always remember you, and I owe you if I ever get to a place where I can pay back." And so I sat with this pianist, and I learned four songs. That was all it took. Didn't require much more than that. And the name of this piano player was Al Haig. And Al Haig was one of the great pianists of the period, with Bud Powell and Thelonious Monk and others. He had his own niche. And I learned these songs with him. And then when the moment of truth came and I was to walk up on stage and everybody knew that I was having my launch moment, walking up to the stage to sit in on the drums was Max. Coming up, attaching his horn to his neck piece, was Bird, Charlie Parker. Tommy Potter went and got his bass and was tuning it, and he was the bass player. And here I was, the first time I ever sang before the public, and my backup band was Charlie Parker, Max Roach, Tommy Potter, and Al Haig. And then in the middle of the set, who should walk up but a very reluctant and moody-looking Miles Davis to do his thing, and I was launched.
Are you optimistic? Are you affirmative? Are you positive? It seems to me that you are in your aura, but how do you feel about the young people and the young movements today and the many miles that we still have to walk before we sleep in the fight for egalitarianism, humanitarianism, social justice, and so many of those issues that have been on the agenda for a long time?
I have great faith and great hope in the human family. Certainly, the movement and whatever it will become today, dealing with the issues of today, is very different and should be than the movement of 50 years ago. Things change. Movements have to shift and change. And common to all movements, people who are oppressed are resisting oppression. So to that extent, what I opt to do and what I'm concerned about is no different than the slaves who came to this continent or the slaves who were captured in Africa to be brought here. The conditions are very different, but the overall impact is exactly the same. There's still a people here who are living out the residues of slavery and what slavery brought into the culture of this country in terms of race and race oppression. And I am very, very confident, because history bears it out, there will be leaders, there will be people who come along that will spark something that make a difference. I think we tend to look for leaders where we should not be looking for leaders. When I came out of the armed forces, I was very, very frustrated and very unhappy with the black leadership that spoke for the young people of my day. What we did was we found the leaders in our own ranks. We found the leaders in our own community. And it is from that consequence, it is from that reality, that Malcolm X emerged. There was no Malcolm X that I knew of before Malcolm. I mean, there were other leaders who served their moment in history who had now become completely ineffectual. Dr. King, Fannie Lou Hamer, Ella Baker, all of these people came out of the ranks of the struggle. They were people from their communities who brought their particular gifts to the table. The fact that they turned out to be who they are, and they became this deity and these icons and these larger-than-life figures, is a coincidence to it. Not every person who comes to the table to make a difference can become a Dr. King or a Malcolm X, but they're hundreds and thousands of people in villages and places that are leaders who command the peoples in their community are doing remarkable things to make a difference. I've just come from East St. Louis, where I'll be spending a big part of my future. It is by all definitions the worst black city in America. And if you go to that city today, there's a black woman by the name of Mayor Powell. There is a superintendent of schools by the name of Nathaniel Anderson. The elder of the community a woman by the name of Mrs. Young, is in the state legislature. This community has put together a remarkable political package. They beat the machine. They got all of the corruption out of government. They're solidly rooted. I met with the police chief, the fire department, the city council, all of the teachers. The people are coming back to that community to make a difference. There's an uplift. Even Governor Ryan, who in Illinois, by all measure, for those who come from the left or those who use simplistic definition, not everybody on the left does that. I'm not making that couplet. But, you know, here's a guy who came into office on the issue of death penalty. He was for it. He is the first governor who has ended the death penalty in the state of Illinois, who's getting a second look to the whole justice system. He just gave East St. Louis $57 million towards the school system as the first installment. Nobody knows about East St. Louis. You hear about it as well as it's where Miles Davis was born, which is coincidental. Chuck Berry came from there. Jackie Joyner, one of the great women athletes, has gone back to East St. Louis and she's put together a sports complex that is unbelievable. When I walk in, it's not just about athletics, because the kids who come in there to train and to be get it off on sports are also required to go take class. You don't walk into this community center and not have a computer and get homework done and whatnot. It's a remarkable thing going on there. I'm inspired by that. I'm inspired by the young people that came out of Lincoln High School to hold a press conference and look at this young black boy and these young black girls that were there with their pencil and paper talking. And I was quite taken with one of the students, and I asked him, how committed was he? Was it just a curriculum response, or did he really like being a journalist? He says, I love it. I said, you like to be a journalist when you grow up? He says, yes. I said, well, I want to stay close to Superintendent Anderson, and I want to track your high school record. If when you get through with high school, it's what you still want, I'll do everything in my power to make sure that you get into a fine school of journalism and that you'll become the journalist. And that's my payback for having met you today. And the kid looked at me and said, I hope I'll be around long enough. I mean, you just have another couple of years to go, so I think I think I'll be here. There are communities like that, that people are making valiant efforts. And I go to those places. You say, well, how do you do it? I got something to do every day I get up. Life is really exciting.
Well, you're really exciting, too. It's been a pleasure. You've been gracious and an inspiration, aside from your talents in the theater and in film and TV and music. The inspiration of seeing somebody who can commit themselves to the uplift of the human endeavor, who is not coward or oppressed in spirit, ultimately, by the many difficulties that people have to overcome of race and class, as you put it. The fact that, and the word stuck out, that you're not indifferent. That you're not indifferent is tremendous inspiration.
I've got to respond to that with just this observation. I am genuinely confused and genuinely conflicted in the fact that the world in which I live and the work in which I do carries such a reward. I mean, to have made it, I had no choice but to make the commitment to what I do, given from where I was born. It's staying the course. I think most people who are born in poverty resist poverty and protest against it. But when I had access to a platform and access to some power, and we can sit down and really try to define that, for Martin Luther King to be my colleague, for him to call on me to come to be in service, was an opportunity that blossomed into such an experience that there's nothing I could imagine in my life that could replace that. For Nelson Mandela to call and to say, come be part of the cause that I am designing here, what reward. But that young boy in East St. Louis that interviewed me in this high school, and to look in his face and to know that I could make a difference in stimulating him to have a sense of expectation and purpose, and I want to stick to it, all that stuff makes me go back at home, and when I'm going to bed and I review the day, I say, well, wow, this was a good one. And I can't wait to get to it tomorrow because I know somewhere in this world out there it's going to be another Fannie Lou Hamer, it's going to be another Odetta, it's going to be another Huey Masekela, it's going to be another Lester Young, it's going to be another Malcolm X. I mean, who doesn't want to get up with all that expectation? So I'm having a great time, a great time.
Harry Belafonte, we've had a great time listening to you, and the recordation of your experiences, they're a good roadmap for other people who need to stay the path, because we need a whole lot of folks. They're out there, but they need to stay positive and affirmative, and you're very much an inspiration to them doing that in the fight for social justice and transformation. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you both for having me.
This Building Bridges, Your Community and Labor Report special, a conversation with Harry Belafonte, was produced in the studios of WBAI in New York City by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Other Building Bridges special reports can be listened to over Internet Real Audio on our website, www.buildingbridgesradio.org. Our email address is knash@igc.org. See what I